This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
Golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original series. I am Ken Tripp.
And I'm Zach Moore, and we are thrilled to launch Standard Orbit Phase 3.
Yeah, I guess that means we are the NCC-1701 -A in either timeline. And speaking of that, we're going to dive deep into Star Trek Beyond. Finally, we've been getting our systems aligned to the new format. We've had a little extended shore leave after Star Trek Las Vegas, and now we're ready to punch it.
That's so, right. The parking brake is off.
The parking brake is off. That's right. You had to check your, what was it, the inertial dampeners? I don't remember.
Who knows?
Who knows? But all I know is it was released. So here we go. So Star Trek Beyond. Zach, let me get your initial thoughts of the movie.
I really enjoyed Star Trek Beyond. I feel like it is the Star Trek movie we deserved. It was a return to form after, you know, you've heard our discussions on Star Trek 09 and Star Trek Into Darkness. The general consensus between, well, me and you, Ken, was that Into Darkness was a little bit of a disappointment. Same thing with Jeff. I know Norm is a big fan of Into Darkness. But I feel like we're back on track. I feel like this is the sequel that I wish we would have gotten after Star Trek 09. Because it, not only is it, it was a fun, entertaining movie, so it's a fun joyride, summer popcorn movie, but it actually had some good Star Trek messages to it. And it really felt like an expanded episode of the original series. You know, it felt like of the flavor of the show. There were lots of character moments, you know, the crew, you know, whenever you break up the crew and they each get their own kind of, you know, adventure to go on and storyline and subplot, that's always great because they each have their moment to shine. Everybody got that. Idris Elba was great as the villain. We can get into that. Ironically, I believe what I said in our Star Trek Into Darkness discussion was, you know what, these movies that always feel like you have to have a twist, I'm sick of them. I wish they just tell us who the villain is and get it out of the way. Of course, as we all know now, it's exactly what they did not do here. There is a twist with Idris Elba and his character. We can get into that later. But all that being said, I enjoyed it. And yeah, it really left me like really eager to see the next Star Trek movie. And which I wasn't necessarily that jumping for joy about where we go next after Into Darkness. I'm completely back on board. Justin Lin did a great job taking over for J.J. Abrams. You really can't even tell the difference visually. You know, it's the same visual language as the last two films, and that's always, you know, you go back and you look at franchises where there's a director change, and a lot of times you're like, oh yeah, pretty obvious. You know, you look at like the Batman movies of the 90s or even the X-Men movies, you know, the early X-Men movies when Brian Singer left and Brett Ratner took over for X3. I feel like the handoff from Abrams to Lin was great. Simon Pegg wrote a great script. He's obviously a huge fan, and it shows. Very respectful of the material. And even all the absurd aspects like, you know, the motorcycle and sabotage, you know, being played came across very well as well. They really embraced the fun and the absurdity there. And I was like, you know what? I'm with you guys. You guys got me on that. So I really enjoyed it. And I'm really looking forward to Star Trek 4. So what about you, Ken?
I'm pretty much aligned with you, Zach. I'll tell you what was fun is a few episodes ago, we were talking about Star Trek 6. And after Star Trek 5, I remember my biggest worry, concern, and sitting there in the theater before Star Trek 6 started was, please let this be good, please let this be good, please let this be good, because I'm a fan of the movies, I'm a fan of the Kelvin timeline. I, like you, I loved 09, I didn't hate Into Darkness. I didn't like it as a Star Trek movie. As an action movie, I thought it was technically exciting to watch, but it didn't work for me as a Star Trek movie. So I was really hoping that I would like it, and I was also trying to ensure that I was keeping that that ability to be, I guess, dispassionate about it and just say, yes, is this a good movie or a bad movie? But right away, it pulled me right in, and I could see that this was going to be a very strong, and it was a very strong movie. And it's interesting to me how Star Trek, on many occasions, has looked internally in order to improve their product. And what I mean by that is, you know, you look in the original series movies, and I wouldn't, you know, Star Trek II was great, Star Trek III was pretty good, but boy, did it really start to take off with Star Trek IV, right? And it was his second movie with Leonard Nimoy, and he had a lot to do with the story, just like he did with Star Trek VI. And, you know, they made this great film, just this really, really enjoyable film that was able to be appreciated by general audiences. And you look at First Contact, right? I'm not a big Generations fan at all. They turned inward again with Jonathan Frakes. And they pulled off a really good movie. And then if you go to this one, you know, this is the third film that they've had as the reboot series, and they turned inward again, and they looked at Simon Pegg to come up big, and he did, and he did a wonderful job. And I think the handoff to Justin Lin was phenomenal. I like his style. It was still a pretty fast-paced movie, but it wasn't your next, you know, getting whiplash and trying to keep up with it as a fast-paced movie. So I think it hit its marks. I think all the character development was great. I enjoyed it thoroughly. I felt like I was watching a true representation of Star Trek in a Star Trek film, and I was very happy when I saw it the first time, and then as I started, I've seen it three times, I guess. The next two times, you know, when you after the first time, you're just kind of sit there in awe with your mouth open, and you're trying to catch every little detail. And then you're more comfortable the second and third sittings, where you're trying to poke out and find all the little Easter eggs and things like that. And the movie was just fun to go back and see a couple of times. And I'd like to see it again before it leaves the theater. So at this juncture, it's just about done its run in the U.S., even though it's opening now in China and Japan and a few other places coming in the next few months. But it was a good ride, Zach, and I think you put your finger right on it. It felt like an extended episode. It felt like this is Star Trek, and I give a lot of credit to those, because I know there's a lot of people that kind of wrote off this new interpretation of Star Trek, which is unfortunate. Because like every Star Trek we've ever seen, there's good and bad. And, you know, fans the way they are nowadays, it's like they can be very unforgiving. But hopefully a lot of people have gone and seen this movie, and they have a different opinion of what can be done in the Kelvin timeline. And this cast, boy, the chemistry just works. They have become those characters, and I feel like they own them. They really have their arms around it.
Yeah, I got to say this about the cast. One of the weaker links of the last two films has been, to me, has been Kirk. I really didn't like the angle they took with him. Not Chris Pine's fault. He was playing the part as it was written. But I feel like they finally wrote Kirk as a adult here, you know, as like a seasoned commander. He's not like frat boy Kirk, stereotypical Kirk. Chris Pine's Kirk was probably my favorite part of this movie. So, I mean, for me, that's huge, because, I mean, one of the weaker links of the last two movies, for him to be the shining star here, he really came into his own. And I didn't see this, oh, it's this, the reboot Captain Kirk. I saw, hey, that's Captain Kirk. And he had this was a great story for him. And so I was very pleased to see that with Beyond.
I agree. There's a lot of great character moments in this movie, a lot of them. And I think you see the maturity in Captain Kirk. And they started writing him the way he should have been written from the beginning. I understand he's different because of the way he grew up in this timeline. I get all that. But I thought they played a little too hot and heavy. You can be tongue-in-cheek, and you can wink back to the past, and you can have fun with things. You know, just like they did in Star Trek VI when, you know, he's fighting Iman, and it's himself, and he's, I can't believe I kissed you, and that must have been your lifelong ambition. What a great, you know, play on himself. And that's the kind of thing that I think is funny when it's a little bit of a wink and the nod to the audience. And you're right. I think in the first two movies, this James T. Kirk, a constant rule breaker, and that was never his character. You know, it never was his character. Yes, there were some occasions where he made decisions that were quote unquote against the rules and all that other stuff, but that shouldn't define him and his character and his career. And this movie finally got us away from that and put him in the center seat with all the, I guess, you know, heavy lies the crown, all the responsibility and everything that goes along with being responsible for. I can't remember how big this ship is. I know it's as big as the Next Generation ship, right? The D. So I don't know if it has 1,000 people on it, but let's say it's 1,000 people. That's a lot to be responsible for. And you could see that it definitely had an impact on him. You know, just instead of being the cowboy and running these missions and running back to Earth, being 3 years in space, the impact that has on him and his team was very apparent. It was very well written.
Right, right. And, you know, speaking of character moments, we've been, you know, both been hitting on that point. I think, you know, to start off the movie strong with a scene between Kirk and Bones, which is very reminiscent of the Captain Pike scene in the cage with Dr. Yeah. Boyce, and then you know, other similar scenes with Kirk and McCoy throughout the show. Just a quiet moment between the two guys, two friends, you know, kind of sharing their heart over a glass. It was just nice to start out kind of, well, you know, we had our real action opening, right? But then immediately following that was this nice slow moment between the two of them. And that's a moment you would not have seen in the first two films.
No, I agree. I agree. And so you're right. That with Bones and Captain Kirk, very special. Bones and McCoy being separated had some great lines in that piece. And openly laughing and smiling. I thought that the relationship between Scotty and Kayla was also phenomenal. They played those characters very, very well. And then Uhura and Sulu. And, of course, Kirk and Chekhov, too. So, I mean, the whole dynamics, the pairing off, I think I was like a lot of people when it was made very clear that very early on in the show the Enterprise gets destroyed. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh no! I really was hoping for more of a being on the bridge type movie, where they, you know, that type of thing. But you know what? I can't. They did it right. They had that all right. The action sequences in that were powerful. It was done very well, and it really allowed us to see these characters flourish, all dealing with different issues, and it worked well. So. Yeah, I agree with you. I thought the Bones and Captain Kirk moment was really special. And I think all the other moments that happened within the movie worked very well, and it all culminated perfectly, I think, at the end. I think they wrapped it in a very nice bow at the very end when they were celebrating Kirk's birthday.
Mm, yeah, because you keep this under wraps, then it throws them a surprise party. That was a great moment. And yeah, you know, throughout the whole movie, you know, the Spock and Bones, right? We finally got some more of McCoy and Carl Urban's McCoy here, because I mean, yeah, he had the first half of Star Trek 09, he had a big part because he was, you know, Kirk's best friend at the Academy, but then criminally underused in Into Darkness. And yeah. It was good to see him more prominent here, especially his little subplot with Spock. And pretty much throughout the whole movie, it's him and Spock are, you know, buddy cops. So they play off each other great. And Carl Urban, right? I mean, he's, to me, he really, out of all the characters, out of all the casting, he's the one that comes across the most of, like, the channeling DeForest Kelly's Dr. McCoy. Not in a parody way or anything like that, but just, man, I can totally feel it with him. The even through all the catchphrases and all that, it's he elevates it from just being, you know, oh, he's dead, Jim, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. He's a real character, and yet it's still, it's like the true spiritual successor to DeForest Kelly's McCoy.
Yeah, and you know, when we talk about character moments, the scene where Spock and Kirk reach that mutual understanding that it's going to be McCoy that has to pilot that craft at the swarm that's going towards the Yorktown. And I thought it was set up beautifully with Captain Kirk and his, oh man, he's gonna love this, right? And then his reaction was perfect. I mean, Bones' reaction and getting beamed out and the whole nine yards. It was just a movie that had you smiling all along, because I think it's twofold for me, Zach. You know, I'm an original series guy. I love all the other Star Trek series, don't get me wrong, but I am an original series guy, so I really want these characters to be successful. I want these movies to be successful, because this is what I grew up with, and they've reinterpreted them so well. And that's what I remember most about watching the movie, was just that constant smile on my face, because they had that playful interaction, that amount of familiarity that they really captured well in the Star Trek movies, as well as, boy, even by the first season of the original series, the chemistry amongst those guys was phenomenal. And they just had it. So they, you know, I don't know. I hope it's not lightning in a bottle, but, you know, and I know they're ready to go with Star Trek IV. And I know there's a lot of questions about the finances on this movie. And, you know, they did spend a lot more money than they were intending to spend. And, you know, will it make it? Will it not? Well, it sounds like Star Trek IV has got to go. And that's wonderful. And my hope is that they can take a lot of the lessons that are learned from this movie and translate it into the next one and make it just as much fun, because it's not going to be easy to be this good. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and you know, I just hope they continue the momentum from this film, because yeah, you know, the box office isn't there. Unfortunately, it's the lowest of the three Kelvin timeline films, but you know, I chalk that up to the fact that it took them so long to get these movies out, and you know, Into Darkness was kind of divisive. So you know, now that we have a movie that, you know, anyone I've seen, you know, talk to, internet, real life, whatever, across the board, anyone who sees Beyond likes it. Like, I haven't come across one person who's like, oh, that was terrible. Like, what about, I mean, have you seen anyone that hasn't liked it, Ken, or?
I've seen it on Facebook, surprise, surprise. But no, I haven't talked to anyone or spoken with anybody who thought it was a bad movie or had anything really bad to say about it. I think that there's a couple of factors in its financial performance. One, it came out, you know, mid to late July amongst a mist of other blockbuster movies that just didn't do well at all, starting with Independence Day. And, boy, you can check them all off the box.
It's been a tough summer, yeah.
It's been a tough summer, and the only movies that really did do well were animated. So if you were a little kid and you were going to the movies with your parents, it was great, you know. And I think, you know, you look across the board, Suicide Squad, I mean, it's killing it money-wise, but it's getting panned too. And if you look, Jason Bourne didn't do that well. There was a lot of very expensive movies that, for whatever reason, couldn't find their niche. And I think Star Trek Beyond, if you're measuring it against what it costs to make $185 million, yeah, it's struggling to make money from that. And I know there's additional funds that get tied up in marketing. So let's say 210, 220, for whatever the sake is. But its global haul is well beyond that. So its global haul I think it's in the mid 200s. I'll have to check Box Office Mojo at some point. And it hasn't opened in China yet, which, as you could see when the movie opened, Alibaba is a big investor into this movie, so they're promoting it high. And I know that the cast was just out in China for the premiere last week. And it takes a week or two for those funds to be captured and then loaded up. So I think the movie will do okay. It will make money. It has already been, I guess, deemed profitable, but not like the other ones, which were in the 400 some odd million dollar range, which is crazy money. And I think that for Star Trek IV, if they could produce this show, and I think they could, knowing nothing about making movies, by the way, but I'm thinking they could make a decent Star Trek for 100 to 120 million. You know, they don't have to create.
There's absolutely no reason a Star Trek movie should cost $185 million. That is just ridiculous. Now, I feel like maybe some of that cost came from the, you know, Roberto Orci and their initial team was going to make this movie, and they scrapped all that and had to start from scratch with Justin Lin. So I feel like maybe that's part of the additional cost, you know, pre-production for that film. And obviously that won't fortunately, but hopefully that won't happen again next time. They'll have a clear vision going from the start, so they won't have to, you know, restart things. And you can easily tell, like we were saying, tell a story on the Enterprise. Make it not a bottle movie, but you can put most of it like on a standing set. You don't have to make these giant CGI environments and stuff, which is fine, which is great. It's great to see the scope. And that's what's so great about these Kelvin timeline movies. It hasn't been since the motion picture we've gotten such a big theatrical scope films for Star Trek. Right. But, you know, tell a smaller story just on standing sets, you know, or mostly standing sets. Save a lot of money, you know. Pick a good time to release. I mean, it's so hard to tell who could have, you know, forecasted the fact that we have dud after dud this summer when they pick this release date. But, you know, I've found that maybe, you know, the winter might be the better time to release Star Trek. Although Star Wars now it seems to be putting its flag in the ground for December. So I don't know. You don't want to get released too close to Star Wars. So lots of angles they could take moving forward. But, you know, I did look up, as you were talking there, Ken, I looked up on Box Office Mojo. Worldwide, as of today, as of this recording, Starship Beyond has $231 million in this worldwide box office and still to be released in some other areas. So that is no doubt going to rise. So that's good. And they've announced Star Trek IV already. Yep. So that's coming. You know, since it's the fourth movie, there's going to be time travel. You know, just like this was the third movie and they're going to blow up the Enterprise. and the second movie was Khan. So, you know, that's what we're doing. I guess Chris Pine's going to direct Star Trek Five, but that as it may.
Let's hope not, huh?
Be that as it may, you know, I kind of reference it there. We don't know if it's going to be time travel or not, but it has been said that Chris Hemsworth is going to come in for Star Trek IV, mm-hmm. which is an interesting thing. We can talk about that later when we kind of wrap up our final thoughts on the movie. But bottom line, across the board, people are pleased with this movie, and that is something that could not be said for the last movie. So, just by its very definition, this movie was a success.
I agree. So from that perspective, moving into the movie itself and not the periphery, what was the key impact moments for you in this movie, Zach?
You know, key impact moments, that is, I will say, on the whole, I liked the movie, right? I really enjoyed it. But I would still probably rank Star Trek O-9, me personally, above this one, because I feel like Star Trek O-9 had several moments that were like moments for me. Like, oh yeah, that's a moment. That's a hit me in the feels moment. That's a stand up and cheers moment. Beyond, I didn't feel like it had as many like moments per se. It was a great whole, but there wasn't like, I couldn't tell you like one individual scene that was like, oh man, this scene made the movie for me. You know, there was no like Kelvin crashing into the Narada moment in this movie for me, or old Spock moment here. I couldn't identify one like, oh well, this scene right here is why I love this movie. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. What are your thoughts on that,
Ken? I had several actually, and there were a lot of things that made this movie feel like it all came home to me. And I think the first impact moment was the way that the Enterprise was destroyed and watching Kirk's reaction to everything that was happening around him. I thought it was a powerful moment. And, you know, we talk about saving money, right? But when they spent that money to launch him off the ship and he's looking down at the saucer section going into the atmosphere and all the things that are trailing behind it, and also when the ship struck the planet, just how durable and powerful that ship is, right? I mean, it says a lot for that swarm, and I don't know how many of those ships, I guess, wound up getting destroyed trying to kill the Enterprise. But to me, that was one very powerful moment because I can imagine what it must feel like to be the captain and losing the ship and watching it occur, right? I mean, it's tough. So that was one big moment. I thought that I thought Scotty had several. And I Simon Pegg just does it right. He just plays a great Montgomery Scott, and he plays him, you know, both seriously and he plays him funny. And Scotty was like that. He really was. If you go back to the original series, you know, he would swing. He could be somebody that could be very serious, and you know, he's the engineer, but he could also be the guy with the quips and the lines, and it went from the series into the movies, and Simon Pegg did a great job with that, you know. And I like that he was even a little bit more casual in Cavalera, especially, you know. And that handsome bastard right there is James T. Kirk. You know, I mean, there was just a lot of great little lines like that I thought were great. And then as far as the truest, biggest impact moment for me, you're going to feel, this is where I get all wishy-washy with Star Trek and get emotional, was the new ship at the end. But the second I knew that they were losing the original ship, there was a part of me that was really, really hoping that before the movie ends, before it goes away, there's a new ship. Whether it was still under construction, it would have been fine. The fact that they did that kind of a montage and they did a, you know, that high speed construction.
Yeah.
Yep. Time lapse. Yeah. To bring it in is fine. But I was so that made me smile when the three of them were looking up there and the way the movie ended. I wish it was a little slower because I'm a geek and I really love to check out the ship and the new ship. And I've been trying to capture every picture online I can of the NCC-1701A because the refit Enterprise from the original movies is my favorite Enterprise of all time.
Same here.
You know, it's just sleek looking, and it looks like they've made enough adjustments they made some slight adjustments even to the one that was shown before it got destroyed from the original version, but this one it really looked cool. And I was so thrilled about it. I mean, I can't wait to see if there's some model kits out there and really understand. I'm looking for those things online where they show you this was the Enterprise that came out from 09. This is the one from Into Darkness because the other, you know, there was some changes made when it was put back together. And then this one, to me, the Enterprise has always been my favorite character of Star Trek, more than any of the people. And people say, "Oh, it's always about it's about the people, not the ship." Nay, nay, I say, it is about the vessel that is getting you to these adventures, that brings that family together, that makes everybody feel like they're home. And for me, the movie ended perfectly because they all came home, and it looks like they've got a sexy new home to check out. And so I'm that geek that's waiting for Star Trek 4 and it's like, I can't wait to see what they've done with the bridge. I can't wait to see what they've added.
Were you hoping for a Star Trek 4 kind of ending where they're on the bridge and all that so you could see the inside?
Well, I'm okay that it ended the way it did. I was just thrilled that was that moment. Okay, they have a new ship, so they're continuing.
I thought that was pretty clever that they didn't show you the inside because, you know, as we all know now from Star Trek 4, serious continuity break because the Enterprise in Star Trek 5 looks nothing like the inside of the end of Star Trek 4 because obviously they were using the old set. So that was very clever where they like, okay, here's the ship. That leaves them the ability to kind of redesign the bridge and other things if they see fit, you know, to not lock them into a certain aesthetic. I follow what you're saying.
Yeah, I'm just anxious to see it. But I'm not upset that they didn't show the inside. I think they gave us a great tease. You know, always leave them wanting more. And they did it perfectly. So that was probably – it's funny that it was the last thing, last piece of the movie, but that was the biggest impact moment to me.
Well, hearing you say this, you know, there probably is one. And like I said, not that the movie didn't, like, get me into the feels and stuff. For me, there was one moment when Spock was opening up – when Quinto Spock was opening up Nimoy Spock's belongings at the end, property of Ambassador Spock. He's going through his stuff, and you're like, oh – I didn't know what it was going to be, but I knew they were going to pull something out. And he opens up this little folder, or wallet, if you will, and it's a picture of the original cast from, ironically enough, Star Trek V, which...
It was ironic, but it was still very poignant.
No. I found it amusing it was from that film, but yeah, that was a great moment, and the way the music came in right there, and you could just... Because Spock had his own... throughout all these films, he's had this journey about, like, where do I belong? My home has been destroyed. Where should I go back to Vulcan? And that was his plan in this film, was to retire from Starfleet. And that was even his plan at the end of Star Trek 09. You know, he was like, well, I'm going to go back to Vulcan. And Nimoy Spock was like, no, there's two of us. I can do what you were going to do on Vulcan, and you live your life. And so naturally, you know, Quinto Spock, hearing that Nimoy Spock had passed away, he was like, well, I better go back and do that now. But seeing the picture there kind of is what, you know, carried the emotional journey, you know, for Quinto. Like, no, you know what? This is my place with these people, with my friends. I'm going to stay here. And so that did get me. I really liked that moment. It was very subtle. And to speak further about, obviously, Leonard Nimoy passed away before and during the production of this film. And I'm very hesitant to whenever they try to incorporate that kind of stuff into a narrative, into a fiction. So I'm very like, okay, you gotta handle this very deftly, very, very delicately. And they did. They absolutely handled it as well as it could be handled. And I really respected the way they went about handling the legacy of Leonard Nimoy in this film, incorporating into the story in a completely organic way.
Well, I don't think I can say it better, so I'm not going to repeat it. That moment was powerful. It was just wonderfully done when I saw that picture. And The one area I'll deviate a little bit is, you know, I'm funny with the alternate universes and all that other stuff, and mm-hmm. you know, and people what's the term they use? Suspend disbelief. To me, that's always
suspend your belief.
Suspend your disbelief.
You're right.
So you can believe it, right? And all that stuff. So, yeah, I know it sounds like an oxymoron when I hear it too. And I have always been this guy. It's like, you know, there's people that are so deep into comic books and all that stuff. You know, Jeff's like that, and Norm knows. You know, he worked for DC, so these guys know that stuff. Well, when I was a young kid, I was into comic books, but. You know, there was a certain point where it was like I put that all in the past and moved on. So I have a tougher time, I think, than most going, oh, this is an alternative timeline, right? To me, everything's linear. And if something goes back and screws up that line, then the line before it is erased. And so while I completely understand Star Trek Discovery, it's going to be in the prime time. So there are these two alternates, blah, blah, blah. It's funny, in my head, I don't play it that way, even though I know that's the way it's being played. Stupid as it sounds.
Star Trek itself is contradictory, right? I mean, you episode like City on the Edge of Forever. Oh no, something changed, and now we have to go fix it, or our timeline's erased forever. And then you have episodes like Next Generation Parallels, where it's like, no, everything happens in its own timeline. So Star Trek itself, kind of plays so fast and loose with those rules.
it does, and you know what? I don't care about the rules so much, and you know, that's why I appreciate guys like that who have that ability just to go, okay, hey, you know, it's not real anyway, so just switch it to this is Star Trek Channel B, right? Now you're watching a different timeline. But for me, when he looked at that picture, it brought it all home, right? That it's one family, it's one continuity. It was the Prime Spock that was back in this timeline. This was the timeline going forward. Everything that happened after it is completely and irrevocably changed somehow, some way, so you can start all over again. And I understand, you know, it's like, well, that means DS9. It doesn't mean anything. It just means, to me, it's tougher for me to accept that it's just another timeline, a different reality. I like living in the now, and I found that brought it all back to me. So for me, I really enjoyed that because it just showed that there is a connection between the two. It brought that connection. You know, you stare at that picture that he's staring at, and you smile. You just smile because it was such a warm thing and very clever thing to do. And yeah, I thought it brought old cast and new cast together in a very special and unique way. So that was a very key impact moment, and I think you articulated that perfectly.
All right, and for all you nitpickers out there who said, "Well, how would Spock have the picture from the?" Listen, it's like having a picture in your wallet. You know, he had his whatever. He carried it on his person, small enough, you know, small remembrance keepsake he had with him, and his robe when he was on the jellyfish and got sucked in the black hole. So it's not like he had his uniform or anything crazy. I feel like that picture was just perfect, like story wise too, to have, because obviously he didn't have pack his bags knowing he was going to go to an alternate universe. But a little picture like that in his pocket, completely believable. So just for all you nitpickers out there.
Oh, I haven't heard anybody nitpick it, but I guess they're out there, huh?
Oh, they're out there. Trust me.
Oh, okay. And they probably, well, but Ken, they'd use that picture from your favorite movie. Oh, whatever. I'm guessing that Kim Cattrall was probably in a lot of the promo shots for Star Trek VI.
Well, no, you know, there is one shot in Star Trek VI, which I feel like they probably should have used, but I mean, with just the original seven, but they didn't. So, but Sulu was a captain in that one, so maybe their thinking was, well, they were still the crew of the Enterprise here. But it's all good.
Good. That makes a lot of sense. And it was funny because that's how big a geek we are, right? I mean, the second they show
the picture came from.
Well, there wasn't any debate. You know, as soon as they showed that picture, I went, oh, that's from Star Trek V. I mean, it's funny that we know those little things.
We can immediately tell, what movie it's from.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and there's a million of us like that, right?
Yeah,
that's what's even more scary. We just saw you, all of you, weeks ago in Las Vegas, so we get it. All right, so in your opinion, though, was there anything that was missed that could have been brought stronger into focus in this movie?
If there was one area for improvement, I would probably say I would have liked Krall and the villain, his story, to be fleshed out a little more. Mm-hmm. I understand why it wasn't, because they were trying to keep it a secret, much like with Khan and Into Darkness. But I felt like the twist worked. It wasn't like a I am your father twist. It was more like a V'ger twist, you know. So it wasn't like it didn't irrevocably change your entire, you know, thoughts on the movie. It was just like, oh, that's very interesting. At the end, when it's revealed that Krall was in fact Captain Balthazar from the Franklin who was crash landed on this planet, because you know when they cast Idris Elba, I was like, oh, great. Idris Elba's a great actor. I love Idris Elba. Great to see him in a Star Trek film. Right. And then you see the first like you know clip or picture of him. Like, oh, well they made him unrecognizable. He's in this alien makeup. Why do they do that? I disagree. But then you watch the movie and like, oh, okay, they did bring it back around to Idris Elba because you see his captain's logs and then you see him almost revert back to being a human at the end of the film. So you did get to see his face. So I really liked that part. But I felt like, you know, I don't know how they could have done it, to be honest, but I would have liked to have spent more time with or delve deeper into his motivations and things like that.
Yeah, and I guess there wasn't a lot left on the cutting room floor. So I've heard two stories where there was a lot and there hasn't been a lot, and some of it's fleshed out and some of it isn't. And it sounds like that, you know, now that we've seen it a few times and we've heard Simon Pegg talk to it and Doug Jung talk to it, that you get a better idea of what happened. But no, I agree with you. I think that would have been a key area to understand. I did, you know, watching it the second or third time, I don't remember, when he looked back at the Franklin and he said, ah, there you are, my old friend, or hello, old friend. Mm-hmm. You know, in the first time, I'm saying, why would he be calling Kirk his old friend? And then it was like, ah, I get it. Okay. You know, the second time you see it, he's looking at the Franklin going, that was his old friend. That was his old ship. And it brought that connection, but it wasn't connecting at all in the first movie, first time I saw it. So I do agree with you. I think one of the things, too, that they need to flesh out a little bit more and maybe stop using it as a trope in Star Trek is this whole, you know, this PTSD warrior Starfleet's not military stuff. Sometimes I was like, oh, come on. I mean, the guy was messed up, there's no doubt, and he was sent out on a ship to go explore. You know, it's a very large misnomer to think that that people who spend most of their time in the service, and I'm one of them, and there's many, many, many others that spent most of their career in peacetime, but then when it shifts, can't shift back. To me, that's silly. And you know, what was it? Montgomery Scott said at one point, you know, oh, we're not a military organization anymore. And he said that in Star Trek Into Darkness too, as you know, he says it as they're loading torpedoes onto the ship and all that other stuff. and I kind of laugh, you know, because you know, being military is not a bad thing. And if you look at history, if you look at Captain Cook or any of the voyages or even Darwin or whatever, they were on naval vessels. They were on ships in peacetime exploring the galaxy that also had another, exploring the oceans, not the galaxy, exploring the oceans. But they also had another duty should it arise that if they were threatened to act as a military power. So it's not a bad thing, folks, if you know, for the writers or whatnot of Star Trek, because it was a big debate during the original series all the time. Is it military? Is it not? You can be military and you can be an explorer. They're not counterintuitive. You can be very noble in your profession and trying to seek out new worlds, and you can be noble in the profession of protecting the home worlds that you come from. It's okay. So I don't understand why we have to keep having this line, and I wish they had just let that go. It was just one more thing. I just go, oh, stop it. This is getting old in Star Trek.
Right. Well, I guess that was the fastest way, the shortcut to get to his motivation. You know, it was interesting, you know, the whole Franklin plot line really ties back into Enterprise, which is fascinating because that's obviously the most recent Star Trek before the Kelvin timeline, and this movie like really legitimized Enterprise as far as, you know, they're talking about the Zindi, the Romulan War, the uniforms of the Franklin, and the Franklin itself looked very much like an Enterprise design. So just interesting to have, you know, a TV show that got canceled after four seasons 10 years ago is being heavily referenced in this blockbuster here in 2016. So I thought that was very interesting.
It was interesting. It was great, wasn't it? I mean, that's what I mean. You have that on one end. You have the picture of the original crew, and that's why it's so easy for Ken to say, "Yep, just one continual timeline that got a little messed up."
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it is pretty good. Talk a little bit, Zach, if you don't mind, about the special effects in this movie.
I thought they were great. I mean, you know, we were talking about the budget being so high, but you see the budget on screen, right? So it's hard to complain about it when it looks spectacular. I mean, you look at, you know, you look at the Star Trek Generations, right? And you look at when the saucer crashes and you're like, okay. But you look at it here and you're like, oh, wow, that's amazing. Like, even the way it was directed, too. So Justin Lin, like, he's handling a lot of special effects, but he puts it together well, too. It's a lot of it is about the presentation.
Sure.
So you really felt the scope of everything when the ship's getting destroyed. It'd be real easy for it to feel very generic, like when the swarm's coming at the Enterprise and all that. But it doesn't. You know, it doesn't feel generic. And it's actually a really cool new thing, because you see the Enterprise here as this little ship, and then you see that this swarm of other ships coming at it, and it's a very cool visual. They executed very well, because it's, you know, thousands and thousands of these drone ships, and you really get the scale of everything too, which is important for you know, these guys are crashing into the Enterprise and they're boarding the ship, and you know, all of Krall's troops, I believe, were actually CGI.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure that's true. There might be a couple scenes where they were physically there, but so very impressive, because I just assumed there were just guys in suits running around. That's how flawlessly the CGI, you know, mixed with the surroundings. So, you know, whenever you see a special effect and you don't immediately say, oh yeah, that's CGI, like, that's a success. Like, you know, when they're running around on the saucer section when it's crashed, like, all that stuff looked great. It all mixed very well. And definitely, the money is on the screen, and as usual with these Kelvin timeline movies, I was very impressed with all the visuals.
Yeah, they did a really nice job. The Yorktown itself was, I thought, just an amazing design and concept, and you know, the ship flying through the center of it and all the little portals and everything. It would have been even more fun to explore it just a little bit more. From every aspect, boy, did they nailed it. They really did. And, you know, there wasn't one scene where I'm going, nah. And, you know, that scene, too, where the swarm is just about to kind of envelop the Franklin was wild. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it just was incredible. And, you know, I agree with you. I thought they did a top-notch job in this. And I think the aliens that they created in this in this show were also pretty impressive. They didn't go too far overboard with it. Where you had a lot of CGI crazy, you know, like, let's say like a four-legged alien, you know, anything along those lines. They kind of kept them bipedal and humanoid and all that with different characteristics. But all in all, they, you know, from every aspect, even the topography on the planet, you know, I mean, I know they filmed all that up in Vancouver, Canada. Right. So they filmed it in valleys and mountains and all this other stuff, and what they did with the colors was just really, really cool, I thought. And they did it right. I really enjoyed it. So I can't complain. I don't usually you know, unless it's like a Star Trek V where they literally hire somebody who hadn't done anything like that before and figured they could make it work on a major motion picture, and you know, are shocked when it doesn't. It's one of those things you just go, but this house that they hired, and it wasn't Lucas, I know that. I remember watching the credits. I don't remember who it was. Phenomenal job. So If they can still give us decent quality special effects, maybe not quite so many, I think that's a big piece on why that budget crept up.
Well, there were many set pieces. There was the ship getting attacked and crashing. There was obviously the Yorktown. There was you know, Starbase Yorktown. There was the big Kirk rescuing everyone on the motorcycle. I mean, there's so many big action set pieces. If you just take one of those out and tell a smaller story next time, you have a much more manageable budget. So I definitely think they could do that. But yeah. You know, speaking of aliens, Ken, what did you think of Jayla, who is our main other star of this film?
I think I called her Kayla earlier.
You did, and I was like, should I correct you? I'll correct you
later. No, that's okay. You know what, it's funny, I don't know, I like Irish music too, and I know there's Kaylas and Kaylees and all that stuff in Scottish, and that was what was in my head. But I like Jayla a lot. I think that she was a great character to bring into the fold. I think she would add a lot of I think she would add a lot to the franchise if they were to keep her. So if she goes off to Starfleet and she comes back, you know, everybody says, oh, she can come back as an ensign. Well, I said, yeah, but she could also go. And, you know, we know from some Next Generations that both the academy and enlist in training are both at the same spot. She could come back as a very strong engineering mate or engineering technician, or navigator, like Chief DeFalco or something like that, and just pick right back up, unless we're going another 4 years into the future or something. But so that would be a nice way to bring her back. I thought her character was great. They needed another strong female character. I think they did a lot with Uhura in this movie. You know, she was kicking ass and taking names, mm-hmm. and they've added another one. So you can never have enough. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah. No, she was great. She called Scotty Montgomery Scotty. You know, yeah. It was cute. And then she uses that nickname when she gets mad at him later, and it's sad, and it still works. And I love that she was listening to the quote unquote classical music, right? She's like,
right.
I like the loud beats and the shouting. It's just very cute. And and she had her own little subplot, you know, too, with her family had died on that planet. And I'm thinking back at other moments, because now I feel bad, because like, no, nothing in this film were moments to me. There were moments that I think more about it after hearing what you said. But you know, when she's fighting Krall's secondhand man, like up on the building there, and she sees that Kirk is kind of driving away, and you can kind of feel that she thinks, oh man, are these guys abandoning me too? You know, they kind of got you there, and it was great to see them come back and save her. And then when she escaped her planet and got to see it from space, you know, that was like her moment of like, okay, we made it, we did this. So her whole subplot was great and added another layer of emotion to the mm-hmm. film. And I would definitely like to see her again, because it's rare in these Star Trek movies. You know, you have your, you know, guest star of the week, right, so to speak, and they don't come back, and you're like, oh, but I liked that character. Let's see them again. So hopefully we will see her again. And there are ways they could incorporate her, obviously, and we can talk about that a little bit in our looking forward to Star Trek 4 wrap up here. But yeah, I'd definitely like to see her again.
That was a good call out on your part. Yeah, I think that she'll add a lot of value, a lot of laughs, and a lot of development to the show and keep mm-hmm. people interested, right? Yeah. She was a great character. Okay. So, you know, I don't know if you're big into the musical parts. I believe you are.
I am.
We had a good time at the concert there in Las Vegas. And you know, this is really Bichet's Avenue. But what did you think of the score and the music for this film?
So the score, I like, obviously, Michael G's Star Trek score. I like how the continuity of it from the three films. It's you know, in our Star Trek film past, it's very rare to have that continuity in the music because it changes so often. So it's great to have that. And I don't know if Krall had a theme. I can't really recall one off the top of my head.
I don't remember that, no.
I mean, I remember all the same Star Trek music cues, which are great. So, you know, solid score, didn't really blow me away by any means, but it was there, and it picked up when it needed to, you know, and all the action beats. As for the music itself, right, Bad Robot is obsessed with the Beastie Boys, so he gets sabotaged yet again, but, you know, they really made it work. Although they did take the plot of Mars Attacks and use it to solve the climax of this movie by playing the music really loud and defeating the aliens.
Did you come up with that by yourself, man?
I did.
Wow, that's a great analogy. I never put the two together. Wow.
Yeah, that's the look it up, folks. That's the plot of Mars Attacks, or the climax.
It is,
but
yeah.
They embraced the absurdity of it, right? And they went all in, and I respected them for it, and they won me over with Sabotage. It's like, I never thought in a million years I'd be sitting in a Star Trek movie, and they'd be like, Sabotage! And be blasting it on the loudspeaker. It's really ridiculous. And then the great moment between Spock and Bones in the ship, and he's like, is that classical music? It's like, I believe it is, Doctor. It's just so great. So that's my take on Sabotage, so.
I'm with you, man. I think they did a nice job with the theme. I like Michael G's theme. I do. I like that it's consistent. Mm-hmm. You know, when something works, it's okay to stick with it. They were very, very lucky, very fortunate that in the original movies from Star Trek the Motion Picture all the way to Star Trek VI, and they didn't have continuity, right? You had Jerry Goldsmith, then you had James Horner, then you had... Leonard Roseman. Then you had Jerry Goldsmith again, and then you had Cliff Eidelman, and mm-hmm. and it all moved around, but it worked for some reason. You know, even Star Trek V, the best part of it to me was the music. I thought it was beautiful.
Well, I think Star Trek IV sounds like a Christmas album, but that's just me.
Well, it's a spring in your step. set, you know, where the music has definite beginnings and endings, and it's very solid, and it's kind of a, yeah, it's a jolly fun time, right? And
exactly.
There's nothing wrong with that. I also thought, like, the original theme for Star Trek IV, when you listen to it, it has a mix of that kind of sci-fi big action movie, and then kind of that mix of the happy stuff. I don't know. Rosenman figured it out somehow, some way. He did a nice job. But we're talking about Beyond, aren't we? Yeah. So I think that I like the bombastic nature of Michael Giacchino's score. I really do. And I like, you know, kettle drums banging and this big, you know, I think it makes Star Trek big and sexy, and it's like, yeah, this is cool. And, you know, as far as using, you know, high frequency to disrupt the swarm, you know, it was pretty damn clever. I thought it'll be forever linked to Mars Attacks, and I've got this, you know, this awful yodeling sound in my head watching the Martian's head explodes, and it certainly wasn't cheesy like that, but
no.
But you are right, there is it definitely was the same idea, although I think it was actually the music itself in Mars Attacks versus just disrupting the frequency. And
A valid point, Ken.
But at any rate, it's. I wish you hadn't linked those two in my mind. But it is funny. I think we have Star Trek Beyond Mars Attacks, I think, should be the title of this show.
And so it is.
And so let it be said that it be done. So anyway, so... What are your final thoughts on Beyond there?
Now that I've completely derailed your line of thinking. like I said in the opening, this was a great, not just a great Star Trek movie, but a great movie. Great fun time, you know, for all ages, you know. And I really enjoyed it, and I feel like we're back on track. The franchise is like, okay, we got... Because before this came out, like you said, people were like, well, I'm not too sure about this reboot timeline, and, you know, it was only two movies, but now we have a third movie, and it was good. It kind of makes it legitimizes this whole reboot thing, I feel. And people are looking forward to the fourth movie because, like I said before, people were like, okay, well, let's get our trilogy out of the way and we can get back to our quote-unquote real Star Trek. That's what some people's attitude was, unfortunately. But I feel like now the tone has really shifted back around to, okay, great. These are great movies. It's gotten Star Trek in the public eye again. You know, I'm excited about the next one. And I absolutely am. And you know, speaking of, you know, what I want to see next, you know, I would, you know, obviously Anton Yelchin passed away, unfortunately, tragically. So there's a void there for Chekhov. You know, Chekhov was great in this movie. Anton Yelchin was great in this movie, great actor, real shame to lose him. But he's, you know, he's not going to be around for Star Trek 4. J.J. Abrams has said they're not going to recast, and I completely agree with that decision. That's the right way to go. So we have a character opening. Jayla, as we discussed, she could come back and fill in. I think that would be the logical choice there. You know, they could get real crazy and do like Lieutenant Eriks from the animated series if they wanted. Their options are limitless. But I feel like, you know, it's obviously they weren't thinking these terms when they created Jayla, but having her go to Starfleet Academy sets it up perfectly. So I'd like to see her again. You know, the crew's going to be together, and you know, these actors have really gelled, I feel, everybody in their role. And, you know, I really like the new uniforms, by the way. I know that at the time I felt like, that's an odd change. Why would they change the uniforms, you know? But they're a little simpler, I feel. Because the ones from the first two were a little overly stylized. Like, you see the Delta Shield throughout the whole pattern. I'm like, you don't really need that. These are a little simpler. And the woman uniforms got sleeves, which I actually didn't – someone had to point that out to me. I didn't realize that there is – oh, they finally have sleeves now. So then we can see their rank. That's a nice change. So, you know, moving forward, they have the Enterprise A, like we discussed. You know, so exciting times for Star Trek. So I really enjoyed this one, and I'm really looking forward to the next one. They said Chris Hemsworth's going to be in it as George Kirk. And what form that takes, I am not sure. I would assume time travel. But I'm a big Hemsworth fan. I love him as Thor. It would be great to see him back on the franchise interacting with Chris Pine. So that's going to happen too. So, yeah, I'm really excited moving forward. So good job, Star Trek Beyond. You did your job well. You celebrated the 50th anniversary well. And people are happy.
Yeah, you summed that nice. You summed that up very well, Zach. All I'll add to that is... I hope that they've created a much steadier platform they've built a real solid foundation to launch additional movies. I think that there is no reason why the movies can't continue on alongside of Star Trek Discovery and whatever they're doing on the TV show. I know a lot of people say Star Trek works best on TV. I don't dispute that. But I do like having my favorite franchise be represented in these, you know, very expensive, big productions and really get to immerse yourself into it. There's just something that you can't do on a TV show that you can do in the movies. And if you can get the movie right, I think they play off each other very, very well. So good luck to them. I hope they can. I'm looking forward to see what they come up with Star Trek IV. Every time I hear time travel, I cringe. And then every time I see a movie about time travel, they seem to pull it off beautifully. So I don't know. Somehow that works. So I will see how they do this, whether it's through time travel or through recordings or holograms or, you know, whatever. I guess we'll find out. But it should be fine. Okay.
Well, it's been fantastic talking about Star Trek Beyond here on Standard Orbit. But this isn't the only topic we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
I saw most of the original series with my grandfather between the age of like 2 and 5. So a lot of my early impressions are based on, can a 2 or 5-year-old basically sit through an episode and find something they like in it? Okay, Kirk is running around like a horse, which is kind of fun, I guess.
Standard Orbit.
When it was asked of him if he would be in a role or would be willing to take a role of Captain Kirk, he has come to grips with the fact he is too old to do any of that stuff. And it just wouldn't work, which I thought was very telling. And a great joke about Leonard Nimoy. You know, it's one thing when you go back in time and you still find yourself being old.
Yeah.
That means you're really old.
That was a good line.
That was a good line.
Meta Treks.
The only thing it was missing was a Geordi PowerPoint.
Yeah, about the closest thing we have to a Geordi PowerPoint in Star Trek Beyond, Mike, is Spock trying to point out the location of Uhura's radioactive tracking device necklace.
He gave her a radio tracking device necklace?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So you can find us on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can always stream or download the MP3 file from our website at Trek.fm and grab the RSS link as well. If you're an Apple user, please be sure to hit the subscription button. That makes it easier for our listeners to find the show when they search for iTunes. And we love new listeners, so please, please, please subscribe directly to Standard Orbit as well as the Trek FM Master Feed and help us increase our visibility for new listeners. Also, we would ask you to help us out with Patreon. Well, what is Patreon? Well, Patreon is the method that we use to fund the network. So I would encourage you all, if you can afford it, to go on to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/trekfm, and become a patron. And for as little as $15 a month, you can join Trek FM's Patron Roundtable, which is wonderful. I mean, this is how I found my way onto the network. And who knows what could happen to you, right? You might find your way. And then if you're kind enough to donate $25 per month or more, you get associate producer credit for the shows of your choice. And that's a big deal. And speaking of that, we would like to say thank you always to our associate producers for this show, for Standard Orbit, Renee Roberts, Richard Rutledge, and Aaron Harvey. Thanks so much for all of your support for both Standard Orbit and for Trek FM through Patreon. You can find Renee on Twitter at mres_1701. Richard, you can find at RUT8972. And you can find our buddy Aaron Harvey at GeekFilter, all on Twitter. So look them up, follow them, and thank you again.
And if you'd like to get in touch with us here at Trek FM, you can always find us on trek.fm/contact and look into the sidebar on the show page. Or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. And please leave us a voice message that we can play here on the show. You can hear your own voice on the podcast. Pretty fun. So feel free to do that. And you can also contact us through Twitter at TrekFM or through Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM and the Babel Conference. To find us at the Babel Conference, type the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. Babel Conference is a great way for you to connect with fellow listeners and the hosts of the network. So as for me personally, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach, that's M-O-O-R-E-O-N-Z-A-C-H, And I'm also the host of my own podcast called Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that young Superman TV show. And we're on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. What about you, Ken?
So you can find me as well on the Babel Conference. That's where I like to hang out. It's my favorite spot on Facebook, to be honest with you. It's the safest, funnest, most respectful spot to talk Star Trek on the entire interweb. So look for me there, and feel free to also look for me on Facebook at any time, and feel free to IM me with questions or if you just want to hook up and be friends. Or you can get information from me via Twitter. Yes, I am on Twitter now, at BostonSCPO. That's Boston Senior Chief Petty Officer, SCPO. And I look forward to communicating with you in between these shows, and especially when they drop. That's when it's a lot of fun. So we'll talk to you soon.
So thanks, everyone, again, for listening. And join us next time here on Trek.fm for another episode of Standard Orbit.